Welcome to the Hustlers Manifesto podcast. We jailbreak from toxic hustle culture. We take hustler back from a belief that bigger is better, security is contingent on compliance, and freedom is reserved for the powerful. I'm your host, Sarah Duran. I'm not here to tell you how to make a quick buck. I'm here to change the way work is done so that we can live more meaningful lives right now instead of betting on an uncertain future. If you value this content, please rate it and comment on this podcast wherever you get it. If you're a freelancer, consultant, or solopreneur who needs better strategy for your business, learn more about what I do at fruitioninitiatives.com. Thanks for being part of the movement. Hi, Joe.
How's it going?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing awesome today.
Awesome. I'm super excited to dive into this conversation with you. And we'll start off with just the three questions that we ask everyone at the top. Who are you? What is your work? And why do you do it?
Yeah. So who I am, I'm a father of two awesome daughters that are 9 and 12, and they get a lot of my attention. I have very much primary custody of them. So that fills up a lot of my time. I'm also a person that likes exploring humanity and just like what it means to be human and dig into a lot of esoteric things. I like stand-up paddleboarding. And for work, I get to podcast about mental health issues. I started a counseling private practice back in 2006 and realized I had no business skills in that area whatsoever. And so there were no podcasts about the business of private practice. So I started one mostly so I could just interview people that I should be paying to get their tips, but I just interviewed them for the podcast and then would write about it or talk about it. And I was able to grow that practice and sold that in 2019. And now I podcast and consult and have membership communities to help people build thriving private practices they absolutely love. A lot of us are taught that if you make money, that's a bad thing in the social work world. And to me, I want people to be able to thrive, but I also want them to love what they're doing, that they shouldn't have to have some salesy, slimy practice to feel like they are creating a business they love. And why I do it, I think that we all want to have better lives and good mental health access is part of that. And so looking at just how tough sometimes it is to even just get a phone call back from a therapist when you're hurting just isn't okay. And so helping build a group of therapists that are doing it right and giving people jobs and giving people better mental health access to me is my little small corner that I can help affect the world.
I love it. I think it's so interesting. I have got to bring on a couple people to the podcast or be on their podcast of people who run these like niche communities for specific types of practitioners or solopreneurs or whatever, entrepreneurs, whatever it is. And I always love meeting people who have focus in this specific area, but you're bringing them this like skill set and this mindset that is like an entrepreneurial mindset, but like specific to this like niche group that you are super familiar with. I'd love for you to tell us, the first thing I'd love to talk about a little bit is like what do you feel are the things that entrepreneurs should be thinking about for their own mental health? So like taking it like up a meta level a little bit. Obviously you work with counselors and practitioners who are helping individuals deal with their mental health issues, but Lord knows I like to be 100% transparent about I've had plenty of struggles and battles with mental health myself over the years. But as you're working with them, like how does that translate to how you're helping them think intentionally about themselves as entrepreneurs?
Yeah. So I think one thing that I also didn't note in the intro is I wrote a book called Thursday is the New Friday. That's all about the 4-day work week. And so a lot of, I think, this conversation may revolve around some of those things I covered in there. And one of the big things is that the neuroscience points to that our best ideas don't come when we're stressed out and maxed out. It's when we slow down. It's when we're taking a shower or going for a walk or just allowing our brains to rest for a little bit. With that in mind, a therapist's best work isn't going to come when they're at the edge of burnout. So starting with slowing down is usually where with most of the people that I work with, we look at and say, where are you working right now? How much are you working? Is that in line with what you want out of life? And then we can start to look at if we were to shrink your week a little bit more, what would be the things that you have to put time into? Parkinson's law says that work expands to the time that's given. And so if we give it a week to work on something or a month, we're going to take that time. But the other side of Parkinson's law is the natural bloating of systems. he noticed that in the British Navy, that anytime any sort of sign off or paperwork was put into the system, it was near impossible to pull it back out. So when we allow ourselves to have a shorter work week or less time to work on something, we naturally combat that bloating where we say, okay, I had 20 things on my to-do list to do. I could only get to 6 of them this week. Maybe I should question those other 14 things and why I'm even doing those or putting pressure on myself to do them. If these were the most important 6 things, maybe I should just do those all the time. So it starts to help you think through, what is the best work? What's the best time of day for me to work? What are the best ways that we can use what we're learning from neuroscience to be able to do good work, but then also to have very clear boundaries around when we shut off and when we're going to stop and we're going to allow our brains to bounce back.
That resonates with me so much. Something that I've been thinking about a lot going into 2024 is how can I do less better? So instead of adding things, really, it's like taking things away. The analogy that I like to think about is, I think it's Michelangelo, where he was like, the statue lives within the stone. So the process of making the statue is pulling away the superfluous things so that you're getting to the core of what's there. So you're not adding things to get better. You're taking away things to get better because your best self is in there somewhere. So it's more a process of stripping away than it is a process of adding things on. I think it's the other thing that I'm super curious specifically about the specific types of like people you work with in your community are something that I come across a lot with different types. There's obviously so many different types of entrepreneurs, solopreneurs that do different things and have different business models. And something that I bump up against sometimes is people who operate in practices where it's a very one-on-one, your time to the client type of activity. And to a certain extent, all service providers, I think that's true of them, at least in the beginning. But I'm thinking about like people I've coached in the past, like for instance, like a massage therapist, where it is literally like her hand with that person out day in, day out. And I would imagine that there's probably a leap with some of the folks that you work with where they go from being like, I am doing one-on-one practice and counseling and therapy with my client to how are you thinking about developing a business so that you're scaling that? Because I would think that a lot of the times, and this is true for everyone, you're bumping up against, I feel like I'm the only one that can do that. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you run across with your clients too?
Yeah, I think the natural progression is someone starts a solo practice. They may then add an executive assistant to take phone calls or schedule things. And then pretty quickly, as they get full, the question is, what am I going to do with these people? I feel like I'm leaving money on the table and my modality people like, so they add a clinician in or two and then eventually grow into a group practice. I think that there's people, though, that say, I don't want this big scalable practice. And so then what do we do with them? So you take the massage therapist that you're talking about. I think there often is this fallacy that the only thing of value I'm offering is this massage. Like, why do people come for a massage? It's not just for the massage. It's the feeling after. It's the lead up of, okay, if I can just get to Friday, I'm getting a massage and I'm going to treat myself. So it's something, it's like a bonus to yourself. It's that you want to feel like you're taking care of yourself. So then if we just say, okay, let's take a step above the massage and say, like, why are people coming to me? They want to feel relaxed. They want to feel whole again. Are there any things before a massage that I could add on as a product, an e-course, a automated text message, anything that doesn't require my particular time to do that can also tap into that? It could be a daily affirmation. It could be something else that could be that you negotiate deals with the local food co-op. I don't know. There's all sorts of creative things that you could do that offers value around that healthy living that you're offering as a massage therapist. And then what's on the other side of that? So we call this the sandwich approach. So what's before your service and what's after your service? So what's on the other side of it? When they're done, what can be done that can increase value? So even if you don't charge for those products, now you are a more valuable massage therapist because you then have all these things. You can charge $250 per 90-minute session instead of $150 like everyone else because people are like, oh my gosh, she has coconut water. Like, why do you think that the spas have cucumber water with basil leaves in it? It costs like 25 cents to cut up a cucumber and throw it in a bucket of water. But people are like, oh my gosh, I love their rose water that they have there. It provides a certain aesthetic that makes it feel fancier. So when you look at like the reason that people come to you, there's so many opportunities there to either have things that enhance the overall perceived value or to actually have things that people may want to opt into that are products outside of just that massage.
I love that so much because I think that fork in the road that you talked about with the person who may want to grow and have a larger practice and have a team versus the person who maybe that's not really what I want to do. Like, I'm dedicated to just continuing to be a solopreneur to a certain extent. It's something that I think about a lot with the folks that I work with, because I think sometimes we get pressured into thinking that, like, you get to that place and you're like, okay, I have more work than I can do by myself. And so the natural progression is to hire a team, which could for sure be, I think, the right course for a lot of people. But I also think that I sometimes see the opposite side of it, where folks hire a team and then all they're doing is managing a team. And they're like, now I'm not doing the thing that I love to do. I'm just managing other people. And so I love that you're talking about being like giving people options and being really conscious about is growing a practice with a multi like people under you really what you want? Or do you want to be doing something different? And how can you still think about stratifying that in a way that you're increasing the value both for yourself and the people that you serve?
Yeah, I think thinking through, do I want to be an owner, an operator, or a service provider? So owner, operator, provider, you can have any combination of that. You can just be an owner of a business and not run it and not do the service and not do the supervision. You can be a totally silent owner of some types of businesses. You can be an owner operator where you're also doing the operations, the management, and you're no longer doing the services. You could be a service provider within it, but you don't do the supervision. So all these things we can outsource in a different way. Now your profit margins change, but it may be worth it to have a business that you're just the owner of and you get 10% of the profits for doing an hour a month of work. Or it may be worth it to you to be a supervisor, or maybe you want someone else to be a supervisor. So being able to just be thoughtful on how do I want this to affect my life, that then allows you to do the work that you enjoy and do best.
Love that. Tell us more. Let's dig in a little bit more to the 4-day work week. I think that this can feel like a buzzword or a buzz phrase a lot for people. And some people, I think, feel skeptical about it being an actual reality. So tell us more about your book and what do we need to know in order to make that a reality?
Yeah. So to look at the 4-day work week now, we have to go back about 4,000 years to the Babylonians. And I promise it won't take a century to get back from there. So the Babylonians, they looked down, they saw Earth, they looked up, they saw the sun, they saw the moon, they could see Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Jupiter. And so they saw seven major celestial things. And so when they were in nature, they noticed that the Earth, it took a day to go around and to have the sun come up and down. It took about a year to go around the Earth, and that the months were loosely associated to the lunar cycle. But there's nothing in nature that points to 7 days in a week. So the Babylonians made up the 7-day week. It's completely made up. There's nothing in nature that says 7 days. In fact, the Romans had a 10-day week. The Egyptians had an 8-day week. As recently as the 1800s, the Russians were trying out a 5-day week. So just the week itself is completely arbitrary. Humans invented the week. So this thing that we think is set in stone was made up. So now let's look at how the average person was working up until the late 1800s. Until the late 1800s, the average person was working 10 to 12 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week. So for most of human history, people were working a farmer's schedule. They're working all the time. And it wasn't until 1926 when Henry Ford started the 40-hour work week at Ford that it really took off into something that was bigger than it had been before that. People would protest. People would say, we want less work hours, but nothing really stuck until 1926. And Henry Ford wanted to sell more cars to his employees. And so he started the weekend. It was literally, if they want to get out of Detroit, they'll want to do that faster. And so it was an effort to sell more cars to his own employees that he gave people a weekend. So that then took off. It was embedded in law. But let's think about that. Less than 100 years ago, the 40-hour work week started. So that means that the World War II generation was the first real generation that experienced the 40-hour work week. They were the ones that were like, wow, let's really experience this. Baby boomers were then raised by that generation. So millennials and Gen X, we're like the second generation that has experienced the 40-hour work week. I get this question a lot of, isn't this just like another buzzword? Like the way that we have decided to work as humans has shifted and changed forever. And this 40-hour work week that we feel is so embedded in what is humanity is a couple generations old. And so when we look at that being less than 100 years old, we then look at how we saw that 40-hour work week starting to die. So in the 80s and 90s, there was TGIF on ABC that was celebrating thank God it's Friday. And you had Full House and Urkel and all of that. And we see that Fridays slowly start to die as a productive workday. We see the rise of casual Fridays, wearing jeans to the office, celebrating birthdays, baby showers. And then really the pandemic that came in 2020 was the final nail in the coffin for the 40-hour work week. People left the workplace, worked from home, and realized that this big key performance indicator of sitting in a chair for 40 hours was not anything anyone cared about. It was actually the outcomes of jobs that people cared about more. And people saw that they could do a lot of their job without working 40 hours. And the wasted time of standing around the water cooler, having meetings start late, having unnecessarily long meetings, some of those things are good where it creates human connection and you can better work together. But a lot of it was wasted time. And so now what's happening is a recalibrating of what are we wanting to get out of the people that we pay to work for us? What are we trying to get out of the jobs that we choose to have? And that's starting this discussion around the 4-day work week and other things that pull us away from that traditional model of the 40-hour work week.
So, A, I love that really long-term view, because I think always, not a lot of times, like always, we are limited to like our own bubble of perception, right? And like you said, for us, it feels like this has always been the way that things have been done. I know that when I went out on my own, that was like the number one thing that I was shocked by, where I was like, when I worked for other people, I always felt, I was like, 40 hours made no sense. I was like, I'm getting my work done in way less time than 40 hours. And yet I have to sit here. I have to come in at a specific time and leave at a specific time, even though I'm like maybe more efficient than the like cubicle down the hall or something like that. And so that was one of the main reasons, which I actually didn't know until hindsight after I started working for myself, where I was like, oh, I'm getting way more done. I'm working way less time and I'm getting paid way more money because my value proposition for my clients was able to go way up, where I'm like, as opposed to paying me as a 40-hour a week FTE, you can pay me as a one-off contractor. And because I'm like at the top of my game and expert in my field, I'm able to come in and do what you need me to do in way less time. You also don't have to pay me all the overhead that you're paying a full-time FTE. So I think that is like the framing that you just gave around like that we've been conditioned to a certain extent to think that this is just like the way things should be is super interesting. And as you're saying that, I'm really curious of how you, I don't know when your book came out, but how have you been thinking about the way work has continued to shift like post-COVID? With a lot of people working outside of the office, I've been reading over the last 3 to 4 years, tons of things about like when people work from home, how do we know they're getting their work done? How do we know they're sitting in their front of their computer for 8 hours a day? Like these kinds of things that just feel like suffocating to me. But I feel like this, we're trending even more and more towards this value-based instead of time-based model.
Yeah, I think what this points out is how crappy most managers are. Like, it's if someone's sitting in front of their computer is what you want them to be doing,
yeah.
Is that really what you hired them to do, is to sit in front of the computer, or is there an outcome? You know, I've had a remote team since the beginning of my hiring. My first hire was from Cape Town, South Africa. And so my chief operating person lives in Cape Town. We have 10 employees over there. So I've never met them in person. And I don't know if they're just sitting around. So from the beginning, I've had to say, okay, what is this job doing? What is this role doing? What are the KPIs annually for this? Then let's break down what those key performance indicators would be each quarter. For example, we have a podcast. We do 3 to 4 episodes a week. So far, we've filled out the entire year with podcast sponsors already for 2024. So we're full. So if we're going to do another, say, sponsored podcast episode per week, okay, that team, let's say I need 52 new sponsor spots sold because we want to do another one per week. Now they have a clear goal on that. So quarter one might be reaching out to current sponsors and seeing if they would like to buy a couple extra spots. Quarter two might be curating new sponsors and talking to new sponsors, and maybe any guests that are on my show that seem like they might be a good fit, I might talk to them. So then now I've broken it down for the team to say, here's where we want to land with this department. We want to get 52 new sponsor spots sold for that extra episode per week. So doing that and having numbers for the individuals helps you understand, what are we actually paying for here? And I think what a lot of this points to is that most managers didn't even know why they were in charge of these people. It was, they come in, they do a few things. How are we actually measuring success? And then we have an annual review, and you're not supposed to give yourself an A on everything, but you're not supposed to give yourself an F on everything. So you give mostly A minuses and a couple B pluses and maybe one area that you say, I could really use some improvement in this area. But it's not even like pointing to actual numbers that matter for the company.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. That's another like thing that I'm more zeroing in on with the independent worker or the solopreneur, is that like your effort is your effort. Like it's not getting diluted. It's not getting covered up. You're not able to hide. Like, if you say you're going to do something, you have to do it, right? And we're not paying you based on like hours sat in front of a computer, which I think to your point, truly good managers and truly good, I think, workers in general operate from that mindset no matter what. But I think to a certain extent, a lot of the systems that we work within are set up to make it feel like we're getting compensated for our time and not compensated for our outcomes, which I think creates inverse incentive scenarios where you're like, have people, especially in this, like where lots more people are working remotely, where it's just mouse wiggling. So they just look like they're still logged on instead of actually doing the work.
I remember seeing a guy during the pandemic that he had taken a fan and took this dowel and just attached it to his mouse. And yep. He was like, that's exactly what you're saying. People haven't defined what this role is about.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that I think you said in the beginning, and I wanted to just circle back on it, coming back to this 4-day work week concept, is Parkinson's law and work expanding to the time that you have allotted to it. So if you actually only have 4 days a week, or in the way that I talk to solopreneurs about it, I'm like, you can define that however you want. Maybe you have 4 hours a week. Maybe you have 10 hours a month, whatever it is. It's about figuring out what can fit in that time span. And doing that actually puts these constraints on you where you really are forced to think very intentionally about what you are spending that time on, as opposed to just having 40 hours that you can do whatever you want with.
Yeah, I think that for yourself, if you're the solopreneur or you're growing a business, to think through what do I have to do to keep the money coming in? And so for me, we've got our membership communities, we've got consulting, I've got the podcast. Those are obligations that I have to the sponsors or to people that have already paid us for their monthly membership. So I need to keep doing that or have our team keep doing that. So what's already on my plate? And then making sure that if my plate's full, I question whether or not all that's on my plate needs to stay on my plate, or could I outsource it or eliminate it? Can I give it to a team member? Can I hire someone to do it? Or should I just stop doing some of the things that I'm doing? So really evaluating through what's on my plate. And then having something that we're gambling on. So what's that big risk that if it takes off, it's going to have a huge reward? So often we just grow incrementally by 5% a year, 10% per year. What about the 100% growth? What about the 500% growth? Those things that are really going to be multipliers. So if I was to reverse a few years, I was doing mostly one-on-one consulting work, had a couple other consultants that worked for me. So I was scaling some of my time. I had a handful of mastermind groups where people were paying. I was making probably about twice what I was making in my consulting hour by having the mastermind groups. But then we started a membership community where people pay anywhere from $99 to $150 per month to be a part of this community, to get good education on how to start and grow a solo counseling practice. By now having 200 plus people in that are paying, I show up a couple hours a month to provide them content, or I have a videographer I've contracted for 4 hours a month to have high quality video recorded into courses that they just get access to. So it's like Netflix, where you just keep creating this content, but the actual time I put into this thing is probably 5 hours a month, but we have 20 people paying between $100 and $150 a month, depending on when they came in. And so that then gets more scalable. That allows me then to make more creative things. And then I'm outpacing any competition because I'm just doubling down on those things that are working and those things that are expanding to reach more people.
So I want to go back down to like the maybe more like beginning level. Because I think that there's stair steps of this journey, right? Where you can't totally see what's possible at the next step until you've climbed a couple more up. As I continue to grow my business, I'm thinking about things now, which like 5 years ago, I wouldn't have even thought were possible. And so I'm curious of what kind of advice you would give someone, maybe not someone who's quote unquote just starting out, but they're like maybe a year in, maybe 2 years in. And I'm thinking of maybe someone in, like a type of person in your membership group, or like a solo practitioner, or the advice that would translate over to a solopreneur. But like, how do you start to think about narrowing down your effort to be focusing more on those things that are the highest leverage activities that you want to be doing in order to have kind of that exponential effect?
Yeah, that's such a great question. So I always start slowing down. So looking first at your life to make sure that you're not maxed out. And so peppering in some things that can help you just remember you're a human and you get to be here. So start there. Then I would say, if you already have a bit of an audience, we have this thing called the 3P process. And so getting on a phone call with about 20 of your ideal clients. And if you have some connections, you're going to ask three questions on this call. You'll start by saying either via email or on Facebook or Instagram, hey, I'm exploring building some products. I want to talk to people that are following me. If you're willing to give up 15, 20 minutes of your time, you may be able to influence this product. This is not a sales call. So you're very clear. I'm just gathering information at this point. Would you be up for it? So you want to have people that really are your ideal people you love working with. So you may handpick them. You may put it out onto social media. So get 20 people to have at least a 15, 20 minute conversation with. First question is, how do you describe the pain around the specialty? So for me, it's, okay, you're starting a counseling private practice. Tell me how hard that is. What's that pain like to start it? And so they may say things like, man, I went to grad school and I have a PhD and I'm an expert in anxiety and I have no idea what a profit and loss statement is. I feel so dumb, but I have a PhD. So they're explaining, it seems so confusing, but I know thousands of people have done this before me and I feel like I'm starting from scratch. So I'm now getting good copy on just what does my ideal client say about the pain? And so I'm going to then potentially use that in sales pages or in micro social media marketing. The next P after pain is the product. So we're going to reflect back on that pain. So you just told me you have a PhD. Sometimes you feel stupid. You want to build this private practice, but you just don't know how. It feels confusing. So you're reflecting it back. Then if there were a product that just helped you with that was exactly designed for you, it was like your ideal perfect product, what would that be? And maybe throw some things out that you're thinking about. Would that be a self-paced e-course? Would that be like live webinars? Would that be one-on-one consulting? Would that be some text reminder series? So maybe you throw out some ideas if they seem a little stumped and then ask them what would be in that. So in that course that's on starting a practice, like what would have to be included in that for you to feel like it was your ideal product? So then they walk you through that. The last P is then the price. So what would you pay for that product? So reflect back the pain. You said, this is how you're feeling. You had designed this product. If that existed, what would you pay for that? Oh man, I'd pay $199 for that. Okay. And then double that price and say to them, okay, say it was $400. What would have to be included in that in order for it to be a no-brainer decision for you? Because then you really get to the root of it. If they just said $200 for an e-course, and they're like, honestly, if I had a 15-minute coaching call with you to just help me get started, like that would be worth an extra $200. Okay, so people really like coaching calls. So what this does is you're then having them design the product. They're then giving you validation around it. Next, you want to email all of those people that you just talked to and say, hey, I've decided to do whatever that product was. This is what I heard the pain was. Here's the price point that we're going to be selling it at, but we're going to give you 50% off, 25% off for being an early adopter, beta tester, whatever words you want to use. If you want that, here's what the next 3 months are going to look like. Month one, I'm probably going to fumble around a bunch. I'm going to screw things up. You're getting a discount, so hopefully you're patient with me. By month two, we hope to have released all these videos. And month three, we'll probably do a couple live events just to recalibrate. But once it's set, you're going to get lifetime access to it or whatever you decide. So what this does is it allows you to kill any products before you put a bunch of time and energy into it. So at the beginning, if you don't have 20 people that will talk to you, you have a dead audience. You have an audience that's not going to buy a product. So you better not be putting your time and money into creating a product. You need to have more engagement from your audience. Then if people are talking to you, are they aligned with what you like or what you want to do? So if your whole audience is telling you stuff that you're like, I don't want to make that. Good, we better kill that idea now before we get too far down this line. Now, what about when we get to the price? What if you have a bunch of cheapskates? They're like, $14 is all I'd spend for that. When we did this for Next Level Practice, our membership community that we for a long time were selling at $99 a month, it's now I think $159 a month. We initially opened it up at $55 a month. I went into those discussions because we had this product that was a $17 one-time fee for an automated email sequence. I was thinking the next step after that would be like $20 a month. But people over and over said, for the cost of one counseling session, like $100 a month or so, like that would totally be worth it. So I would have left $80 a month per person on the table if I hadn't had this conversation. The last step of then emailing them and saying, hey, like I just went through this whole process. This is your exact product. Be our first person. Say people don't sign up. Again, you can kill it because your people that are the biggest, hottest leads didn't buy. They didn't pull out their credit card. So you can recalibrate all of those steps.
I love that so much. It is such a perfect step-by-step, really simple process. It's something that I do something adjacent with the folks that I coach. I call it a listening tour, which is basically exactly what you're saying, where I'm like, if you haven't talked to how you don't know if it's going to work unless you go talk to the people that you're trying to sell it to, which, like you said, serves so many. You're validating your idea every step of the way. It's like instant networking. It's instant buy-in. Because the other thing about that I love so much is that people really, at the core fundamental level, they want to be listened to. They want to be heard. They want to be sold to. They don't want to be talked at. They want to be listened to. And so you're building this really natural, authentic empathy with people really from the get-go and checking all these other boxes where you're like doing your market research, writing your copy at the same time. I love that. I love those three P's. It really breaks it down in a super simple way to be able to validate an idea like that.
I went through this process with some of my higher end clients, and a lot of them had been talking about podcasting. And I thought I think I was at like episode 300 at that point and had the whole team and stuff. And I was picturing they're going to want some sort of self-paced e-course on launching a podcast. And I had already bought podcastlaunchschool.com and thought, okay, like I'm going to just validate this just to go through my steps. And I went through this process and the pain was what I expected. But the product, almost everyone said, I don't have time to do all the back end. I just need some done for you program. And I'm thinking, my God, this is going to be so expensive to hire sound engineers and show notes people and transcribers and all this stuff. And then when I got to the final P, I was picturing like a $500 e-course. I said, how much would you pay for a done for you podcast? And almost universally, they said between $18,000 and $20,000. And I was like, are you kidding me? So I sent out the email and said, we're opening 4 spots that same day. I had a 50% down. So that same day we had 4 spots for $20,000 each and had $40,000 extra in the bank just from that. And then I hired the sound engineers. Then I made the system scalable,
yep.
Made sure they knew you're not going to launch your podcast in a week. And this is going to take some time. And then we built that system out. And then we made an e-course about what we had worked out with those high-end clients. It was that cheaper process, but we learned so much with those high-end products that I never would have even tried to launch something like that.
Yeah. The validation like that is everything, because you fundamentally don't know unless you've asked them. I think we can often make the mistake of just thinking and creating. A lot of creators just think and create in isolation. And to a certain extent, you obviously know your audience, but until you're really intentionally doing that type of validation of a product or an offer, you can miss the mark almost every single time. The last thing I would love to ask you about is being a parent while running all of these ventures that you have. I have a 5.5-year-old, 5 3/4 now, I would say. She's getting closer every day. And I had gone out on my own as a freelancer before I had a kid, but she definitely fundamentally changed the way that I look at, everything, right? Time, money, fulfillment, all the things. But I'm curious, in just in this journey that you've been on and having your 2 kiddos, what would you say? I want to say, what is your biggest piece of advice for entrepreneur parents? But I think it's deeper than that. I'm curious about how being an entrepreneur has shaped the way that you parent and how being a parent has shaped the way that you run a business.
Such a good question. So as I said at the top that I'm a single parent, primarily raising these 2 daughters on my own. And it wasn't that way. I uncoupled a few years ago and it was unexpected. And it was also unexpected that I would be raising these kids most of the time. So I think that some of the things that I've held throughout. So one concept that I thought through was how when we leave childhood, there's only a handful of things that our parents, that we really retain from our parents. So my parents, as young as I can remember, I had to save up to buy things I wanted. In 2nd grade, I wanted a skateboard and I had to water the neighbor's garden to make money. And I'm sure my parents gave the neighbors the money to give me, but I had to work to make money. That was a priority. I had star charts to achieve certain goals that I had. As young as I can remember, I was making New Year's resolutions with my psychologist father. So a lot of that was good. A lot of that was I had to undo in therapy and realize that I'm not just what I achieve. And there's a lot of other things that my parents gave me. I was hugged a lot as a child. They even had a sticker on their Beetlebug that said, have you hugged your kid today? So touch is something I definitely have taken out of my childhood experience. So there's a handful of things that your kids are going to take into adulthood. And so for me, thinking through, what do I want them to take? Because if I'm not intentional, they'll just take whatever they want to take into adulthood. For me, one thing that is always going to help them, whether it's in the business world or social world, is being able to talk to anyone. No matter how many texting or AI or computer or Zoom, if you can't just talk to someone that's new and you get all nervous and you don't know how to start and keep conversations going, like that's going to make your life harder than if you can have conversations with people. So that then informs how I do my parenting. So if we go to my partner's parents' house, they're in their 70s. They don't bring their iPads. They bring some things that they find fun, but also I want them to think through the lens of engaging with all generations that are there. So those generations may not want to. Luckily, my partner's parents love hanging out with my kids. But so it's like, what can you do to create a social environment that you like? So what games can you bring that you think 70-year-olds would like to play also? It's not going to be the games that you like as much. It's going to be the ones that I like as a parent and they like. Let's talk about having conversations. So what does eye contact mean? What kind of questions could you bring up? One time, my daughter, she brought a joke book with her. And so it's like thinking through, how do you socialize and making sure that's something that's part of what we do. To me, downtime is really important. I want them to know that they're not just doing things as a human, that they get to be, they get to enjoy life, that they're not just running from one event to the other. So our schedules reflect that. They're in maybe one thing at a time. Sometimes it's, we have weekends that we have zero planned and we just check in. Okay, I want to play Mario Kart with you guys. Okay, I want to go for a hike with you guys. So then really looking at those things that I want as a parent to hopefully be the things that they leave when they go into adulthood. I think that some of the practical sides of this is I work from home. I've worked from home before the pandemic. And so being clear on my boundaries, but also on their boundaries. So we have rituals of connection before and after I work. So if my door is shut, unless you're like, my daughter's literally sick on the other side of that wall. She's homesick today. She knows I'm in podcasts. And unless she's like puking and really needs me, don't interrupt me. And that worked through the whole pandemic. Kids were never interrupting me when I was working. But after I open that door, I always go give them a hug. I say, I'm done with work. As if it's like when you walk in and you just got home from actually going to work. So finding those things that say, I'm working now, and that's important. And so there needs to be a boundary around me being a dad. I'm not going to go get you crackers right now and do these things. Or I'll check in and say, hey, I've got 20 minutes between podcasts. Can I get you anything? I went and just grabbed her lunch and water and helped her with some medicine. So to me, those clear boundaries, clear definitions, and clear outcomes help me and them know what's expected out of the relationship, and also helps me hopefully move towards the kind of outcomes that I want as a parent.
I love that. I think that is the perfect place to leave it. I love to leave it on a note of outcomes for personal connections and raising better humans. Thank you so much for talking with us today. It was a real pleasure. Tell us more about where everyone can find out more about you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me today. This has been so much fun. The book's Thursday is the New Friday. It's available at all bookstores online. HarperCollins published it, so it's everywhere. So wherever you get your books, I'm sure your local independent bookstore would love to, you know, have you go there. But Thursday is the New Friday. That's the book. The 3P process is in there. A lot of the processes we talked about. Also finding your sprint type. So it's similar to your personality type, but how you best sprint when you do want to get things done. That's in there too. And then I have a podcast called Practice of the Practice. It's aimed primarily at service-based workers and owners, like private practice owners, massage therapists, but really a lot of it's general business advice too. So Practice of the Practice is the podcast. We publish 3 to 4 times a week, and we're almost to episode 1,000.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Sarah, this has been great. Thanks.